of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk. This radio program is brought to you by the initiative Titi Paunamu, Study and Joy. Once a week, I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, religions and beliefs, and the care of the earth. Today, I've invited Debbie Miller to a Zoom recording for broadcast. Debbie, a warm welcome and hi to radio program. Debbie Miller is an active member of Bet Shalom, the progressive Jewish synagogue in Auckland. She is a lifetime student of Jewish studies. Debbie, the Jewish community has recently celebrated Passover. Before we hear more about the celebration of Passover, I'd like to ask you about the three pilgrimages in the Jewish calendar. I understand that Passover is one of these three pilgrimages.
You're correct, Beati. The Jewish tradition or Jewish religion originally started with a sacrificial tradition, which goes back 3,000 years in Jerusalem when we established the Temple Mount. And there people we were an agricultural society in Israel, and we would bring our produce or our animals to the Temple Mount for sacrifice. That was the way people communicated with God back in that period of time. So in conjunction with that agricultural calendar, you had three times a year in relation to the plantings and harvest times in Israel that people would bring their produce to the Temple Mount to sacrifice, and they were called the three pilgrimage holidays because that was when you had contact with God. You said, ah, here's what I did, my best animals, my best wheat, my best barley, I'm going to bring it to the temple and sacrifice a part. And you gave part to the priests and part was burned on the altar, and that's the way it took place. And so consequently, they were called the Shlosh Regalim, the three walking up holidays where you walk to Jerusalem and you did your sacrifices. Passover being the first, the second one being Shavuot, and the third one being Sukkot. And this might be of interest to you, which is people came from all over Israel to sacrifice. And one of the things that Jesus complained about was that there was money changers on the Temple Mount, but it was really a pragmatic thing. But if you can imagine, you take your best goat and you schlep him for a 3-week walk to Jerusalem, and after that he's not your best goat, he's a little underfed, he's not fat anymore, your wheat's wilted, your barley looks like it's been run over by a truck. So what people would do is they would sell their stuff and the value, and they would take the money, and then they would go to the Temple Mount and they would buy produce there and sacrifice it, because if you went on a long journey with your stuff, it didn't come out so lovely. So that's what the money changers on the Temple Mount are about. So I thought you would enjoy that.
So you say that it was like a necessity that they didn't have what they wanted to dedicate.
Yeah, or they were what do you call it? A blacksmith. Blacksmith can't sacrifice wheat or barley, but that's what you sacrifice. So they would go and buy it. So it was just a pragmatic sort of thing. But what Jesus was talking about was people making money off at the expense of these people. But to us, it looks like money changers on the Holy Mount. That sounds awful, but it was really pragmatic to begin with. So anyway. Interesting little note of aside.
Yeah, and tell me about the Feast of Passover. It's called Pesach in Hebrew, I understand. In many languages, it's still the Hebrew name. In English, there is a translation, Passover. Is that an accurate translation from the Hebrew, or is it more like an explanation of what happened in the Bible with the angel passing over?
So it is actually... the angel passing over. That's what Pesach is about, and that's what the story is about. The Hebrews were involved with a negotiation with Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said, no, 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 yes, 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 no, no, no. He was like seriously indecisive. And also Moses kept upping the game. You know, first he just asked to go out and pray in the desert. Then he's like, okay, I've had enough of you people. We're going to go on the whole nine yards. We want out. And he kept saying no. And so the if you look at the pragues, they become progressively more difficult for the populace. And I assume that the Egyptians were rebelling, which seems quite obvious if you look at the story of how the Hebrews go in the last chapter before they're leaving, and they ask the Egyptians for gold and silver because, you know, and they were like, here, take whatever you want, just leave already, because all their firstborn children had been killed. And it was obvious when every single firstborn child happened, it wasn't just like an illness, it was in the angel of death. And the Hebrews had sacrificed the Paschal lamb, and that lamb is Pesach lamb, which is the blood of it's put on the doorpost, and then the angel of death knows to bypass the house so that their firstborn was saved.
And so it's then, an accurate
voila, it's time to go, and everybody runs out the door, you know.
Yeah. So it's an accurate translation, Passover.
It's more the Pesach lamb that they're talking about, but it's literally about passing over. So yes, it's accurate. It's just a different component of it, but yes.
So you've already started a little bit about this story. And can you tell us more? I understand the Passover celebration is much about storytelling. So what is the story that is being told during the celebration?
So the Jews were basically a family group who were the children of a man named Jacob, who has a wrestle with God and changes his name to Israel. And he became very successful, and he had families and grandchildren and house workers. And there was a famine in the land. Jacob's son, his favorite son, Joseph, was sold into slavery by his not-so-nice brothers, who were jealous of a little bit of a show-off. Joseph, anyway, I'm getting a little sidetracked. But anyway, he goes down into Egypt. He becomes, through interpreting Pharaoh's dream, and becomes the viceroy of the Pharaoh, and stockpiles all this stuff, and all the people from Jacob's family come down. Long story short, they end up in Egypt. And because Pharaoh has all the stockpiles, everybody has to sell all their stuff in order to get this centralized grain, and people basically become indentured servants, and the Hebrews eventually become slaves. So the long story short, the Hebrews apparently became successful, and even though they were slaves, they were having more and more children, and they went from being just a familiar tribe to being a very large population of people. They did have an identity of being B'nai Israel, the children of Jacob, and they knew they were from Israel, that was the land of their forefathers. But over 400 years as slaves, they sort of lost some of their identity, or I think slavery inherently makes people have a difficult time having freedom anyway.
Well, 400 years is a long time where you tell us.
We don't know how they counted years. It's a little suspicious because there's a woman in the story who remembers Jacob, and this is 400 years later. So it's highly unlikely that it was 400 years the way we count them. So anyway, the long story short, Pharaoh is intimidated by how prolific the Jewish population is growing, and he forbids sons to be born anymore. And this is during the times of Moses. Moses gets put in a basket and shipped down river, and Pharaoh's daughter finds him and raises him in the palace. Now, this is, for me, a really interesting part of the story, because it highlights the point that you actually need to have knowledge of being a free person, you know what I mean, in order to think yourself out of slavery, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He recognized that he was one of the Hebrews, and he went out and saw the abuse of them in slavery and killed the foremen. And then he goes out into the desert and lives for 40 years and learns how to be a shepherd. Also, he's going to be the shepherd of the Jewish people as well. You understand the sort of analogy.
Yeah.
And God comes to him and says, okay, time's up, buddy. You have the education from Pharaoh's house. You know what freedom is. You know what abuse is. You know what it is to shepherd people. Go back. Tell the Jewish people, at that point, they're not the Jewish people, the children of Israel. Tell them you're going to lead them out of slavery. It's like, they're not going to listen to me. You know, who am I? And God says to them that I am what will be. And Moses said, what kind of is that going to be? Whatever I think will be. And he goes, yeah, Asher Yeh, that's my name, which is what will be, will, what I am, what will be. I am what I am, what will be. So it's important because he alters it to say what's been in the past and what is in the future, this common understanding of omnipotence that we take for granted, mm-hmm. was actually revolutionary in this story. And that's what, and Moses says, okay, now, like, give me something to deal with. And Moses goes back with his brother Aaron before Pharaoh, and Moses is not an orator. He's actually limited in his ability to be an orator. It is actually Aaron who speaks. Moses has the spiritual connection to God, but Aaron has this discussion with Pharaoh, and they see these wonders that Moses can do, but the magicians that Pharaoh has can't do. And then they threaten him with plagues. And as I said, Pharaoh was indecisive and says, yes, you can go. No, you can't. Yes, you can go. Blah, blah, blah. We get to the 10th plague. He says, all right, you can leave. They go out of there. They don't have enough time for the bread to rise. They're running out the door. And they put their unleavened bread in bags, and they go to the Red Sea, and
that's why they have the
everybody button. Says there's a sea, and the Egyptians are actually, once again, Pharaoh's changed his mind and has the army following these 600,000 Jews, and he says you have to end the first person to sit their foot in the water. This is what the rabbi said was Joshua, and he goes all the way up to his nose, and then the sea parts. And they all walk through, and they walk through the sea, and as they get 600,000 get to the other side, the Egyptians follow them, and as they get through, the sea comes back and drowns them all. And just about every serious blessing and everything we ever mention on Shabbat, we always recall this miracle.
Yeah.
Because for us, it was the like, okay, God's on our side. We're not going to die. You know, there's all sorts of other things that happened, but that was the aha moment. We believe, we crossed, we made it, they didn't, you know? And so
But Debbie, you said very clearly, you first had to trust, because if the first one had not trust God, he would not have walked into the water.
Right. So this is what the rabbi says. It's a midrash, which means an interpretation. The text doesn't actually say that. It's what the rabbis say as a midrash to explain what's necessary. You have to believe. You have to take that step. You have to walk out of slavery. But even when they walked out of slavery, okay, and lived in the desert, they rebelled and they went back on what they said and they made the golden calves. We are human. We are fallible. Give us a little hardship and we all go, oh no, can we please go back to Egypt where they had gold and food? And so it's not a clear-cut story of, okay, God was on our side, we crossed over, we nailed this. It's not clear-cut, and it really shows the fallibleness of the process of moving from being a slave to being free, and that you can't take it for granted, this freedom, because given a little hardship, we all fall down on our knees. And Passover literally is the retelling of that story, but it's also the understanding that it is something that, yes, it was a miracle, but it has to be retold every year and experienced as if you were there, because as you see in the story, we are not capable of inculcating this freedom into our being. We are constantly tempted by the material, by the things that look better on the other side, even though God has done this miracle. We are prone to forget. And so we make this holiday a week-long holiday where you don't eat any leavened bread, all things that are made with flour or can be leavened are thrown out of the kitchen, and you do all over again, and you have, it's the telling of the story, but it's also the trying to relive the story physically, because you eat certain foods and you dip your things in salt water for like the tears of the slaves, and there's so many different components to it.
You mentioned this now with the salt water, etc. You have a Passover plate. Can you say something about this Passover plate?
So it's called a Seder plate. Literally means an ordered Passover meal. The Seder plate, it's got six little plates on it, and each one symbolizes a different, like the charoset is the bricks and mortar that we use to build the bricks of the pyramids, and the salt water, we dip the parsley in it twice because it's the tears, and the matzah, we have three matzahs on the side that symbolize the different components of the Jewish people, the priests, the Levites, the temple workers, and the people like me, just the Israelites, the common person. And there's this whole book, the Haggadah, which goes through the telling of the story using these symbols on the plate. And it's very much a visceral experience where you actually eat the food, you sing songs, you do lots of different symbolic discussions that took place thousands of years ago about the meaning of it. And it's all been canonized in a book called the Haggadah. And everybody in their home sits down. It's not something that takes place in the synagogue or what you would call a church. It is actually a home-based holiday where everybody goes to their home and they have this organized meal where they sing these songs, they have these discussions, they read the story, and the story is very, very much structured.
Tell me what happens if you don't have a family or if you are traveling. Do you join other families? Is there something?
So it's very much one of the mitzvot, the good deeds that you can do on Passover is to invite other people to your home. It's considered a mitzvah to invite people to your house for Passover. And so most people will have guests to their home at Passover because that's what you do. It's you're also supposed to give to the poor or to anybody who doesn't have money to have a Seder. We have a committee in our synagogue, which is the I guess you'd be the Take Care of People Synagogue Committee, and they actually give matzah out and the materials out for people to have Seder if they don't have it. And so, because it is quite expensive here in New Zealand to do all this.
Where does the matzah come from? Is it produced here in New Zealand?
No, it's produced in Israel or America, or maybe there's other places in the world, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's not produced here.
Is the Passover celebration like a central celebration for Judaism?
Yeah, the central celebration. I would say, you know, there's something that's said in Jewish tradition, which says that if you do not circumcise your children or you eat, you eat chametz, bread on Passover, you will become disconnected from the Jewish people. It's very, very stringent. I'm not saying there aren't tons of Jews who don't observe that way, but I'm just trying to explain the gravity of being part of this tradition. Like, you're supposed to celebrate Shabbat. It's considered the main holiday of the Jewish people. It happens every week. There are lots of people who don't do that. Most people observe Passover Seder.
So is it the same celebration?
It'd be hard to find people not to do that.
If you're a traveling Jew, can you go to anywhere and you always have the same celebration?
Yeah. I mean, some of the foods differ. Not the food symbol, but for example, the Ashkenazim who are from Northern Europe and the Sephardim who are from North Africa and Israel, they tend to make haroset that's made out of what's available in the area that they're from. So the Ashkenazim make it out of apples, walnuts, cinnamon, and wine, and the Sephardim make it out of dried fruits, almonds, walnuts, you know, cinnamon, and, you know, spices that are there. But it's the same brown gook that looks like a brick, you know? So there are differences, but they're based to the way, and the tunes of the songs are different, but the songs are similar. Some songs aren't. Like, Hadgadiyah is written in Yiddish. So obviously the Sephardim don't sing it in that format. So
yeah. Do the children have a special role during the Seder meal?
Yep, very much so. The youngest child, once they are able to read, even when they're not able to read, but the youngest child's given the job of asking the four questions. And if you know anything about Jewish learning, it's not about frontal presentation. It's all about asking questions. So they sing the song, Ma Nishtana HaLaila Hazeh, and they're usually from the age of three, most kids can learn that part of the song, even if they can't read it, and they memorize it, and they ask the four questions, which are, you know, why is this night different from all other nights? Why do we dip our vegetables in the salt water twice? They're asking the key questions to understand why we're doing all these different things that this meal that we don't normally do. And that's the job of the youngest child. And the person who runs the Seder has to answer the youngest child. So it's very much, there's also another part of the Seder, which is called the Afikomen, where they take three matzahs, and the middle matzah, they break it in half and they hide it. And at the end of the Seder, the kids search for the matzah, and then they come back and they bargain with the head of the Seder for a prize. And because everybody wants a piece of the afikomen, because they eat it and it gives them luck in the coming year or whatever, some sort of whatever. But the point really is to keep the children's interest till the end of the Seder, because it's quite long. And if there's people like my family, like we have a 2-hour discussion or argument about what the meaning of the wise child versus the child who's evil, and we're arguing about what's right and wrong, and you know, we get off topic and we, you know, discuss the story.
What's the story about the wise child?
So there are four children that are discussed in the Haggadah, and there's the wise child, the child who is evil, the child who doesn't know how to ask. I can't remember what the third one is, but whatever. There are these four children, and they talk about who they are in terms of Jewish knowledge. Do they understand why we're doing these things? Are they ignorant? Are they deliberately evil? Are they just, they've never been exposed to this?
Is it like a role play?
No, it's actually a specific text.
Okay.
But those of us who, it's actually the wise son. And I always change it to child because I have a problem with the sexism of it. But also for example, this time, instead of discussing the text, we talked literally in my household about what is wisdom, what is evil, what, you know, we had real discussions, not just with regards to the way the text presents it, but to the regards to the way we present it and how we evaluate things in life. But that's really the question the text is asking too. It's just in the context that it was written in the medieval period, this was their context, this is our context.
Right.
And that's what you have to do to make things relevant in every age. You take what's written there, but you also try to apply it to your lives today.
Thank you very much, Debbie. Oh, we've learned so much about the Seder meal and about the traditions around the Seder meal. And I hope that we continue. We'll look at some other topics in the Bible. And thank you very much for sharing your knowledge.
And my pleasure.
And what you say about this asking questions, that leads us also to our next session on Titipona with Study and Joy, where we have a session called Bible Stories, What Do They Mean? So we are looking at Bible stories, and people can bring questions that they've always had about the Bible. And within the group, we try to find the right answers. Sometimes there are no right answers, but we will discuss about it, and we'll have Bible scholar Karen Finn to support us. The next session is on Sunday, the 5th of May, 5 to 6 p.m. on Zoom, and we are holding it every first Sunday of the month. And please also check out our wide range of video clips on more topics about religions and faiths. There are also several video clips with Debbie Miller, who you've just met, online. And so for further information and registration, please check out my website at www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, keep safe, and thank you, Debbie.
Out there, oh, peace is calling, in the bonds of love we